welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended or to be construed as legal advice. We hope that you enjoy the program.
I'm Kenya Johnson, Chair of Ogletree Deacons Diversity and Inclusion Legal Practice Group, and I am excited to facilitate today's discussion as part of our ongoing Diversity and Inclusion at Work podcast series. Today, we're highlighting laws, ordinances, and guidance from around the world that has been focused on diverse populations that have been most impacted by the novel coronavirus or COVID-19 pandemic. The decision-making involved to comply with these new laws in ways that do not undermine diversity inclusion efforts can be quite an undertaking. And so today we thought it would be a good opportunity to be able to focus on ways that employers, and particularly global employers, may think about how to tackle these issues. I'm happy to be joined today by Bonnie Puckett, who is a shareholder in our Atlanta office. She's also a member of the D&I practice group and the cross-border group. She is a highly sought-after speaker and author who most recently penned a lot of resources that we have available in our D&I legal surveys, model policy, and compliance toolkit. She regularly counsels global clients on a myriad of legal and compliance issues, but she can also do so from what we call a diversity lens. Employers with a global workforce, we know, are challenged in many ways. But when it comes to implementing a diversity and inclusion program, grasping the myriad of laws, navigating different cultural understandings, and absorbing the new complexities of COVID-19, even social protest and unrest, shows us that global employers do not have an easy task. So, Bonnie, let's start there. When we talk about a global workplace or global workforce, what is meant by that?
Thank you, Kimya. That's a really good question. I think any employer that's headquartered in one country with employees or contractors in another is well served to at least think of themselves as global in some sense of the word. There is often a headquarters, local subsidiary tension. There are language barriers, culture clashes that come into play. There's border restrictions, travel back and forth, and of course, different political dynamics and workforce populations that when we're looking at diversity and inclusion in particular, having multiple countries really does make a company global in the sense that they have to contend with these global issues.
Yeah, that's really insightful. Well, we know being in the United States, that whether at the federal, the state, or local level, we've seen a myriad of laws, orders, and guidances coming down, it seems, daily to address COVID-19 and other most recent events. What are some of these other countries doing in that legal landscape? Or what should global employers be mindful of with the myriad of maybe even conflicting laws coming down the pike all around the world?
As a baseline for United States headquartered employers, there are two buckets, United States employment law and everywhere else. That's largely because U.S. law recognizes at-will employment, and for the most part, that's not a thing outside the U.S. Further, that makes employers' jobs more complicated when implementing these myriad orders about workplace safety and response to COVID-19. Outside the U.S., there are many countries in which, for example, there is occupational medicine system that is completely different and that is intimately involved with the COVID-19 safety protocols in the workplace. Additionally, just as we're seeing so many different orders that U.S. employers have to keep track of within the U.S., that is multiplied tremendously abroad, where there are so many different approaches that governments have taken. There are some countries that didn't impose lockdowns at all. There are some countries that are still completely locked down. There are some countries that have already opened up. The definition of essential businesses are quite different. The infrastructure is quite different. And importantly, for diversity purposes, the populations are quite different. And the approach to the discrimination and the applicable laws regarding diversity inclusion will differ fundamentally from country to country.
That's really interesting. So we know, you know, in the United States, at least, that we certainly have societal views, but even legal views around workforce diversity. And you know, we often talk about, when we're talking about diversity in the workplace and the programs that are being built to support them and the laws that provide the boundaries by which those programs are being implemented, you know, we're usually talking about race, gender, sexual orientation, sometimes ability, and other identifiers. How are some of these other countries addressing diversity? Because presumably they don't have Title VII, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, or some of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, or some of these other laws that some of us have become very familiar with here. How are other countries addressing this diversity concept and defining it?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right, Kimia. The framework for discrimination in the U.S., the legal framework for discrimination and harassment, Title VII, the ADA, the ADEA, OWBPA, all of these laws are quite different from what we see abroad. And that really comes back to the fundamental difference between U.S. and non-U.S. employment structure. Outside the U.S., it's contractual, which means that employees have rights not to be dismissed at will, that they need to be given notice, payment, and in some jurisdictions, they have to have a reason for termination. Therefore, the employment law is not so much centered around discrimination claims, although those definitely exist in many places outside of the U.S., but it's more centered around the fairness, whether the decision was fair, whether the process was fair. So it's completely different framework. Employers in the U.S. are quite focused on avoiding discrimination. And one thing that comes out of that is that it's the framework for discrimination, preventing it and preventing those things in countries where the employment laws are different, the policies are different, and the processes are different. So there's a couple of differences I want to highlight. And these are really conceptual differences more than legislative or regulatory specific, even though those definitely exist, but in broad brushstrokes for global employers. One thing that we as U.S. employment lawyers have been really trained on is quotas are a no-no. And if we discriminate based on one of our protected categories, that goes in both directions. So it's colloquially referred to as reverse discrimination. That concept is largely not a thing outside the U.S. either. If there are protections, they are often only for the oppressed or minority population and not for the majority. So for example, in India, there is a law that was passed in the early 2010s that protected women from workplace harassment, but had no protections for men. The inclination for a lot of U.S. employers is, well, we are going to implement these policies equally. There's also some discrimination built into some other legal frameworks that would enable discrimination based on certain categories. Protected categories differ from country to country and often include things that we wouldn't normally think of as federally protected categories in the U.S. Political philosophy is one example. Certain criminal offenses is another example. So there, it runs the gamut. There, one call out that I do want to make for global employers is I get the question a lot about countries in which discrimination, for example, sexual orientation discrimination is legal and in fact built into the legal framework of a certain country. This comes up a lot where a global company wants to have a global diversity inclusion initiative, and either from the local HR, local team, or just because of their knowledge of the law, they are worried about potential liability in those countries. So my answer to that usually is, it's impossible to comply with all laws worldwide. And if you think about the purpose of diversity inclusion initiatives, in countries where the laws are oppressive, these individuals may need that protection or benefit from that protection the most. So it would be inconsistent with values the company is trying to demonstrate to exclude those employees from inclusion initiatives. Now, what I usually say is, nobody is requiring you to, you know, take signs in the streets in Russia about LGBT rights, but it isn't something that is worth avoiding or diluting your global values for. So that is the line, that's an example of the line that global employers have to walk. The other fundamental difference in terms of what you pointed out regarding the US statutory framework versus others, so we have all of these key terms that we use, and this is particularly relevant with COVID. The ADA provides a lot of the employment law framework for COVID-19 response, for how to deal with disability accommodation. We have a lot of terms that are second nature to us, like reasonable accommodation, undue burden or hardship, those types of concepts that, depending on the legal system, they do not exist. It's a completely different framework. And the definition of disability is much different. The definition of accommodation, or whether accommodation, what that looks like, is also different. So trying to map US response to a request for accommodation onto the world is very difficult, very tricky, and often out of sync with the framework locally that often involves government benefits, et cetera, for responding to illness. So COVID-19 wise, that also comes into play with regard to public health guidance about vulnerable workers. Many countries, in fact, have their public health authorities and or other government agencies have defined a category of individuals that are at higher risk of illness. Of course, employers that are headquartered in the US are paying a lot of attention to the CDC guidelines, and the CDC has spelled out this topic as well. And the company has operations in 50 countries, 20 countries, and is looking for public health guidance to inform its global return to work and how it deals with vulnerable populations across the globe. What does that look like? Do those categories overlap? And what does the employer have to do about it? It looks a lot different in countries, for example, where the age of someone is defined to be at higher risk. What's that number? And wild card is that a lot of countries have a mandatory retirement age where employees either must under law, like in China, or under company policy, which is true in Japan, or the concept of mandatory retirement is another one that under the Age Discrimination in Employment Act in the US, we are a little bit more allergic to for obvious reasons. But in other countries, this mandatory retirement framework causes local HR and employment law to approach that much differently. So when we in the US are responding to, hey, what do we have to do if we have some workers who are over whatever age and they can't work? What do we have to do? The answer to that question is going to vary based on the local law and the local definition of high-risk worker. And there are also protected leaves of absences that global employers have to work with. Now that you've heard a long list of all of the differing, possibly conflicting laws affecting your diversity inclusion framework in response to COVID-19 and generally, I want to take a step back and say the law is a starting point. It's important to be aware and know what you don't know about your operations and the country's laws that they're in. But the danger with that is that the global values might get lost in the mix. And at a time like this, with what's going on in the world, in the US, and with everyone at a heightened degree of intensity with this pandemic and responding to it, it's so much more important to focus on the values and on building trust with your workforce. Really, that is going to be what helps employers manage return to office and their COVID-19 response and keeping their moral compass front and center at a time like this.
So that's a good point. And I know you've given a lot of information about not only the various laws, but even the different definitions in some ways as to who is quote unquote diverse. And it sounds like it varies widely. And what I have found even in working with some of our clients is that just even having an understanding of the concept of underrepresented minority, quote unquote, is a concept that either isn't recognized in some countries, or to the extent it is, who that quote unquote underrepresented minority is very different. And even some countries having wildly different views around race and ethnicity and gender and different dynamics in some countries. I mean, I don't know if you found this to be the case as well, but protections around gender may exist, but not really around race or ethnicity. So having a good handle as to what are the distinctions, not only in the legal landscape or policy-wise, but even culturally is
yes,
really helpful.
That is really absolutely helpful. Right. The workforce populations within various countries differ. The concept of race is something that some jurisdictions may be very unfamiliar with. And the result is that their understanding possibly of these categories, of these issues, of these, Lena. Of what difficulties Lena. These groups have faced. I lived in China briefly after college for a year in a very small town where the population was Chinese, and largely the concept of race was not the same thing as it is here. There are ethnic minorities in China. They are called Shaoshu Minzu, which is very close to the word for underrepresented minorities in the US, even though that is kind of a US buzz term that you don't hear necessarily in other countries. And there was a lot of, from my perspective, possible to perceive some of that as tokenism for people who think of race in a certain lens that, of course, they think of it in that lens. It's different, and there needs to be some understanding of the potential for culture clashes. Since they knew I was an American, everything I'd say for children who hadn't met an American before, I was representing my entire country, basically, for that. There's a lot of funny stories and examples I can say. But for global employers, they have to manage that, and they have to maintain awareness and sensitivity to culture and to educate on these concepts that may have been unfamiliar. With regard to the gender issue, it comes up a lot. You know, Me Too was a global movement. And I have just heard so many clients come and say, well, XYZ behavior, you know, obscene gestures or, you know, certain phrases, et cetera. That's just what we do here. That's normal. I think that is changing post Me Too. There's a lot of laws that have come out afterward. Just last week, China put out a new civil code that fleshed out sexual harassment a lot. Japan has taken on bullying a lot. And I think that one difference between US and non-US law is that bullying outside the US, it's called various things, abusive conduct, power harassment, et cetera, that is something that can be used to kind of smooth over this the issue of, hey, we don't have those concepts of protected categories here, and we don't understand exactly why those categories are protected in this country, because we don't have that institutional knowledge and historical knowledge. The idea of treating people with respect and being inclusive and training on implicit bias and all of those things can be really helpful when those stereotypes are not only within a country's list of protected or vulnerable categories, but also within the whole world's list of issues along that regard.
Yeah, I mean, it can almost seem overwhelming, particularly for those of us who are looking at the compliance and have the compliance lens. I mean, compliance almost become in some circles a buzzword, but it really isn't. I mean, compliance and global compliance is certainly a massive and complex undertaking, and just hearing the myriad of not only legal, but cultural issues that folks are mindful of can make it seem as if it's just a lot of areas to be aware of, even in that compliance space. But you did highlight something when we spoke that I thought is helpful. So oftentimes folks say, well, where do we start? Where do we start? Understanding that, you know, we may have a workforce in Asia somewhere, or maybe we have some European operations, or maybe we have, an office in the UK, and we also have an office in Dubai, all very different, not only regions and places in the world, but culturally are coming to the workplace can be very different. So where do you start? It sounded to me when we were talking earlier about the importance of having a value, a company value, and starting with that and having that value consistently communicated across the world, even when there may not be legal requirements to do so. So can you just talk a little bit about the importance of really having that consistent statement and communication across your workforce?
Absolutely. So right now, everyone is buried in compliance out of necessity. Here are the main ones that we need to think about right now, maybe even more than ever before, and that there's a risk that we'll get buried in them and maybe forget about these bigger global values, or that they will take a back seat. One zoom out on the word compliance is, who is responsible for your compliance program? It's your employees. If you don't have employees that are versed in, trained in, and able to, and motivated to implement your compliance program, you won't have compliance. So in some ways, if you don't start with the employees, if you don't start with engagement, inclusion, healthy workplace culture, and a support structure for employees, that's a compliance risk too. So that's one sort of level setting thing I like to remind global employers of, because when you get so many balls in the air regarding these subject matter areas of compliance, it's difficult for a big picture to emerge sometimes. So the areas of compliance that touch most on this are, first, data privacy. This is really all over the place in terms of when you are dealing with sensitive personal data, and that is, most data privacy laws worldwide, including GDPR, have a heightened standard for sensitive data, and that would include race data and medical data. And so looking at the data privacy laws is a compliance matter that is going to be relevant to the program and can cause a lot of getting into the weeds over. Pay equity is another compliance issue, as multiple countries have pay equity reporting requirements, and governments have implemented these subsidies in response to COVID-19. Employers have to deal with juggling that and also maintaining the pay equity. Pay equity is going to be an issue maybe a few years down the road if women, as some sources have reported, are bearing more of the childcare burden when children are out of school. Will that set women further back on pay. We don't know, but that is something to watch from a compliance perspective, and also a reason why your building trust and support and inclusivity with your workforce can actually benefit you in compliance. Other areas of compliance that are very important: immigration. When you have expats going back and forth, there is an opportunity for cultural interchange. And now that the borders are closed, global companies may have less of that. It's going to be remote more often. It's going to be Zoom. And how is that going to affect people's abilities to interact and understand one another? The global employer may have even more of an uphill battle to maintain visibility without such freedom to transfer people back and forth on business trips just because of the post-border entry quarantines. And we don't really know how long those restrictions are going and how the travel, business travel, is going to be impacted. Payroll compliance and tax compliance is another compliance area that employers are dealing with COVID-19, along with in terms of how that loops into diversity. We can think again of the pay equity issue, and also just keeping track of leaves. That often becomes a payroll issue in many countries, especially when the government subsidizes sick leave. And then finally, the idea of just a global compliance program where employers in the U.S. are required to have codes of conduct. Public employers are required to have codes of conduct. This is a real opportunity to include respectful workplace, diversity, inclusion, global values of that nature in your compliance program. These are the ways in which those responsible for compliance can interweave those with their global values.
Well, a whole lot of excellent insights have been raised, and you know, there is no shortage of issues that employers are grappling with in their global workforces and through their global workforces. And you know, I encourage folks, if you can, to see what Bonnie has really put together in her compliance checklist and extensive surveys. If you have an interest in knowing about that and other tools, you can certainly contact anyone at Ogletree Dinkins to help you get that information. So Bonnie, thank you so much for sharing with us today. And I would like to leave folks with thinking about who you are as a company, who you are as a company can translate all around the world, and don't be afraid to share it. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Dinkins podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended or to be construed as legal advice.